Not this Wednesday, of course. This week, Adam and I have switched since they're out of town. So if you weren't here on Wednesday and wonder why I'm teaching, that's why. But he'll be teaching this coming Wednesday. And then, of course, he'll be back on schedule for Sunday. So the following Wednesday after that, we're going to be studying chapters 4 and 5 of Nehemiah. So if you want to keep that in mind, that's what we'll be looking at next. And I'll try to remember to say that again at the end. But I'm not sure if I will or not. So, well, we've turned the page over to Nehemiah from the book of Ezra, and as we talked about a few times now, this really was one book, one long story, originally, not two separate books as we have it in our Bibles today. So we're not going to take any time to do a new introduction to Nehemiah. We covered a lot of that stuff before we talked about both of these books. So we're just going to jump right into the text. But one of the things that we noticed in Ezra, starting particularly in chapter 4, was that the restoration effort that they were making faced opposition really at every turn. The first three chapters, everything was great, and it looked like it's going to be smooth sailing all the way. And then chapter 4 begins, and from that point on, they face trouble all the way. There's a string of stories in chapter 4 where it kind of leaves the story of Ezra aside and looks into the future, and you see one thing after the other of trouble. And then after all those various local leaders who oppose Zerubbabel's work, Ezra shows up on the scene, and the sin of the people themselves is an obstacle to him and what he wants to accomplish in his day. And then that continues in Nehemiah, where every time he makes a successful advance in what he's trying to do, he's met with opposition by his enemies. And sometimes it's explicit what the opposition is. Sometimes it just mentions that they're there, which I think is enough to show that the continued theme of opposition shows up repeatedly. For example, in chapter 2 and verse 10, when he first shows up back in Palestine, Sanballat and Tobiah are just displeased with the fact that he's there at all and what he wants to do. In chapter 19 and 20, when he announces that he's going to rebuild the walls, they mock him and they question him. In chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, it's still Sanballat and Tobiah in the presence of the chiefs of the Samaritan community, or the Samarian community. They're not Samaritans yet, I don't guess. And the Samarian army, he mocks Nehemiah's successful organization of the rebuilding effort. Chapter 4 and verses 6 through 8, the wall is being built. It's worked up to half the height that it needs to be. They're filling in the gaps in the wall, and they're there as well, threatening to fight them and to stop them from working. In chapter 4 and verse 15, after a brief break, the nation gets back to work, armed with sword in one hand and trowel in the other hand, is one of the more familiar scenes from Nehemiah. But the enemies are there as well in that verse. Chapter 6, verses 1 through 9, Nehemiah has come up with a plan of defense against the enemies and what they want to do. And at this point, they turn to personal attack on Nehemiah, questioning him and his motives and calling him names and all those fun kinds of things. And then finally, in chapter 6 and verse 16, when the walls are complete, the enemies are mentioned there as well. There it specifically says that they realize that God had been with them along the way, but still, it's an advance in Nehemiah's plan, and the enemies are right there, and it's just every step of the way, they're there opposing him, what he wants to do. And that's what we'll see unfolding, and of course, that's not the entire story of Nehemiah, but that's the bulk of what he is trying to do is rebuild the walls. And every step along the way, they're there. And we'll see how that unfolds as we get more into the story of Nehemiah. Taking a big step back to chapter 1, and I don't know that there's anything remarkably important on this PowerPoint. It's just kind of the points as we're going through them, so don't expect to be wowed. I guess that's kind of true of every PowerPoint I've ever done, so I don't know why I'm saying it now for the first time. Well, the book of Nehemiah begins with a report to Nehemiah. Someone has come back, a family member, one of his brothers, he says in verse 2, and reports to them, verse 3, they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. A couple of things about this verse before we get these verses before we specifically get to what the report was. It gives us something of a time frame of where this is happening in relation to the last page before we flipped over to Nehemiah. We find here that it's in the 20th year, most likely the 20th year of the king is what is being alluded to there, which indicates that 13 years have now passed since Ezra left for Jerusalem, which he left in the 7th year, I guess that math works out to be, it says back in Ezra. 13 years have passed, and probably it's at some point during this intervening 13 years, from the time that Artaxerxes sends Ezra back to the time that he sends Nehemiah back, that we have that little story of what happened back in Ezra chapter 4, verses 8 and following, where there was this guy that didn't like them working on the city, and so he sent a nasty letter to Artaxerxes, if you remember, and Artaxerxes writes back and says, "Stop building." And so the king had made a policy that the wall of Jerusalem was not to be worked on. And he leaves a little loophole in his letter. He says it's not to be worked on until I say it is to be worked on. But even at that, it's not going to be an easy thing to change a king's mind. And that's exactly what Nehemiah is going to be faced with because Artaxerxes has made this royal decree that the walls of Jerusalem are not to be built. But Nehemiah finds out a few years later, the walls are in ruins. And the question is, what exactly are the walls in ruins from specifically? What's being referred to at this point? Clearly, they had first been destroyed by the Babylonian Empire when they came and they wiped out Jerusalem and the temple. And that may be what's going on, in which case the force of what the message is, the point that he's making is the walls are still in ruins. We made one attempt to try to fix them, and that was thwarted. Our enemies now have the royal backing. We're not going to get anything accomplished. But it seems to me that if that was what was being talked about, if Nehemiah was being told the walls are in ruins because Babylon destroyed them, well, there's nothing really newsworthy there. I mean, Nehemiah knew that the whole time. What's the big deal of reporting the fact that the Babylonians destroyed the wall 70 years ago when Nehemiah already knew that the Babylonians destroyed the wall 7 years ago? And in fact, the first thing Nehemiah does when he hears this is he sits down and he weeps and mourns for days, and he fasts and prays. If it's something that happened 70 years ago that's old news that he already knew about, it seems like it's just an odd thing for him to have that kind of reaction. So maybe what he's referring to, what's being discussed here, is that decree of Artaxerxes. They had been trying to work, they've been trying to rebuild, and Artaxerxes says, no, you can't do that, and the enemies took that as an opportunity not only to stop them from working, but to destroy what work they had done, to further tear the walls down from what place they had been left maybe by the Babylonians. Of course, there's nothing in the text that indicates that, so you kind of have to read between the lines to get that, but it's got to be one of those two things is what's under discussion, or something completely else that we really have no idea about. Well, Nehemiah reacts to this with weeping and mourning and praying, and his prayer in verses 4 through 11 is it's an impressive prayer from a variety of ways. One of the things that's striking about it is its structure. It's one of those chiasm prayers, which if you don't remember, you'll see in a second, it has parallel points working into a center point. And in this kind of structure, the middle point is always the one that's most emphatic. That's what the real point of everything is driving to get to that point. And without confusing you further, without showing it to you, it begins and ends with what we might call an invocation, asking God to hear him, asking God to act. The next stage are two confessions. There's a negative confession, we might call it, in verses 6 and 7 regarding Israel's sin. And then there's a positive confession in verse 10 regarding God's redemption. And then the centerpiece, the center point of all of this is God, Nehemiah's appeal to God to remember the covenant, to remember the promises that God had made. He refers back to Deuteronomy 30 specifically and asks God to act on the basis of that. And like I said, when you have this kind of structure in Hebrew thought and in Hebrew writing, it is always the middle point that carries the greatest emphasis. And so the real thrust of Nehemiah's prayer, all the rest of it is important, of course, but the real emphatic point of all of this is God being faithful to His covenant, them still being in a covenant relationship with God. That's what is the main thought of Nehemiah here, that God will act on the basis of His covenant. Questions about that before we look at some of the details of the prayer specifically?
Just, if you could refresh my memory, why is it called a chiasm?
It's called a chiasm because it's hard to see in a straight one like this, but it's based on the Greek letter chi, or chi, which is an X, and you kind of see it A, B, C, B, A, like that. It's also in poetic lines where you'll have, it'll be A, B, B, A, and it forms like that. I was trying to think of an example off the top of my head, but I can't. Hang on to this. I'm going to need it in a second. All right. Well, some of the specifics of what Nehemiah is praying in verses 4 through 11. Let's go ahead and read his prayer. Picking up in verse 5, I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps the covenant and steadfast love with those who love Him and keep His commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. We've acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your dispersed be under the farthest skies, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place that I have chosen and make my name dwell there. There your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name and give success to your servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. And then he adds, now I was cupbearer to the king. Well, the first thing that I would point out about what's going on here is Nehemiah has read between the lines a little bit, we might say, of what the report from his family member had been. This delegation had come back to them, and their report was nothing more than the fact that the city was still torn down, or it had been torn down again, or the tearing down had been worse. Really, it was about the reproach of the city in the eyes of its neighbors. Everyone else looks around, and it's a bad situation there. But Nehemiah sees past that and understands what the true source of the problem here is, which isn't the fact that the walls have been torn down, but it's the fact that Israel hasn't kept the covenant. Israel has sinned. They've not done what they were supposed to do. And there's no word of any of that in what his family had come and told him, but he understands that's really what's going on. And then the next thing that jumps out to me about this prayer that I think is extremely significant is that Nehemiah is coming to God empty-handed, but not uninvited. And I think we all stand in that same situation. What is it exactly that we can bring to God to compel Him to listen to us?
Nothing.
Except the fact that He said, if you come to me, I will listen to you.
But he'd gone with a very broken and contrite heart too, which God always seems to look favorably upon.
Absolutely. But ultimately, Nehemiah's confidence, the reason he can approach God this way is because God had made the promise that you can approach me this way. And he bases his confident appeal to God on Scripture. There's no backstepping. Sometimes it seems to me that when we pray according to the will of God, we might say, that it, instead of praying according to God's will and confidence of what God's will is, we say according to God's will as if it's a giant step backwards and no, not really, I don't mean that, God. God, this is what I want, this is what I want, this is what I want, only if your will's the same way. And while I think there is a valid approach to God in that way of humbling ourselves to His will against what we want, at the same time, if we know what God's will is, there is no reason whatsoever to take a giant step back that way when we're asking God for something. And that is exactly what Nehemiah is doing here. He knows what God has said. God has said it in black and white. It's right there, so let's appeal to it and be confident in what God has said. And I think we can do the exact same thing. If we know what God has said about a matter, then let's just go ask God to do what He said about it.
Not He wants us to depend on Him rather than ourselves or others.
Absolutely. And ultimately, the point here, as much as anything, is that that Nehemiah has nothing he can bring to God. He realizes he's a sinner. He realizes the nation that he's a part of is a sinner. Yet at the same time, he is confident to go before God. And I think there's not one of us that doesn't stand in that exact same position, except we need to also be confident to go before God.
Apparently, he's been in prayer for 4 months, from the 8th to the 1st month.
Yeah, that's something else. We're going to talk about that a little bit more when we get into chapter 2. But this, you get the idea that he gets the report, he says this prayer, then he goes to work the next day, and all of this in chapter 2 begins to develop. But 4 months pass between chapter 1 and chapter 2, so this is a long-standing prayer. We don't know if he says it exactly the same way every day or what the case may be. But it is certainly constant work on his part. And ultimately, I think what it does as much as anything is remind us of God's promises. It's one of those kinds of things that when we tell God what He's promised, He already knows it. And of course, there is biblical language of God remembering things. And of course, it doesn't mean that God had forgotten, but that God is being true to His word ultimately is what that means. But the same thing is true here. We remind God. What we're doing is reminding ourselves of what God has said and why we have confidence that God is going to do such and such, whatever it may be. Well, then at the end of the prayer, we find two clues looking forward into chapter 2. He says, today or this day, give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. Which tells us two things. First of all, that he's decided to act on what he's been praying about. Now, as Brother Winton brought up, this 4 months have passed from the beginning of chapter 1 to the beginning of chapter 2. So he began praying immediately, but he didn't act until some 4 months later, which tells us that Nehemiah has persevered in prayer and fasting for quite a long time before he finally decides to act. But by the end of chapter 1, we are at the point where he has decided to act. Today I'm going to do this, give success to me today. And then we also find really the object of prayer, this man. And we know who it is in retrospect because we've all heard the story of Nehemiah before. But if someone is reading through this for the first time, a Jew perhaps that doesn't know the story and he's going through this, he might be quite surprised to find the end of that verse, now I was cupbearer to the king, that he's not just asking any favor of anybody, but the object of his prayer is the emperor of the most powerful empire in the world who rules over everything. And so he really needs God's help in this. And then you add to the fact that Artaxerxes' most recent word regarding the walls of Jerusalem is stop working on it, then he's really going to need some help at this point to make things go the way that he wants them to go. Yes, ma'am.
What was so incredible to me, and you're probably going to say it anyway, is that he really doesn't have to act. He just has to have the faith to do what he needs to do because Artaxerxes opens the door for him. He doesn't have to go up and ask him for this.
Right.
He just can respond to him, but he has to have the faith to do so.
Yeah. And you see how that is. The very first thing that it says in chapter 2 about that, when the king says, "Why are you so sad?" And he tells him, and then the king says, "What do you want?" And I can't find it. Oh, it's verse 2, right after the king says, "Why are you so sad?" He says, "I was very much afraid." It's part of living in a, you know, democracy several thousand years later, but we've really lost the idea of what it means to stand before someone who is the most powerful person in the world, who at a whim can have your head lopped off. You get a picture of that in Esther as well, where his wife, one of his wives, can't go before the king without being summoned unless he's in a good mood and decides that he wants to see her, in which case, you know, he raises the scepter and she's all right, but otherwise she's going to be killed. The same thing is true here. The emperor asks him a question, and he's afraid to answer a question. And you really get a picture of just how serious this is in regard to this. Well, jumping on up into chapter 2 then, of what's going on, it begins with this exchange between Nehemiah and Artaxerxes. As we mentioned, this is 4 months later. It's not an immediate request on at hearing the bad news, which tells us, I think, something about Nehemiah's sad countenance at this part, that he's gone before the king, and the king notices that he's sad. Well, either he's been sad for 4 months, and it was such a blow to him that it still affected him 4 months later, and somehow the king didn't notice the intervening 3 months, and all of a sudden, "Oh, wow, you're sad. I hadn't noticed that for the last 3 months. Let me ask you what's going on." Or this was part of Nehemiah's plan to get the king's attention. He's there with the king all day, every day, for the most part. The cupbearer has a very important job. He's not, you know, going to take vacation for 3 months. The king would have noticed if he'd been so sad this whole time, but we do realize that his appeal was planned. Today, when I ask this, grant me favor, remember the end of his prayer. So what he does is he's wise enough to, I mean, he's cared about by the king, and he knows what the king's last word on Jerusalem was, so he presents it as a personal blow to him, not a political issue. Not Jerusalem, you said they couldn't rebuild the walls, and I want to rebuild the walls. This is something that's devastating to me as a person who you care about, and it's a very political kind of way of going about it, even if it's not political.
The first verse says he had not been sad before this, before the king. So my personal thinking is that, you know, he's made up his mind, he's going to talk to him, and he's really maybe grave in his demeanor or whatever, because he knows, "I've got to speak to the king today."
Yeah. That's certainly a possibility, that the fact that he's so concerned about the having to talk to the king is let him loosen up. Loosen up's not a good phrase, but not be so concerned with how he appears. Or maybe he intentionally lets himself appear more sad because he knows that's what will prompt the discussion that he wants along the way, and then he poses it as a personal issue from that point on. Notice he never mentions the city of Jerusalem. He's smart enough to, you know, not poke a stick at the king and what the king had talked about last. Surely the king would know, especially when he talks about Judah and the city of my father's graves in verse 5, that he wants to rebuild it. Obviously, the king's going to know what he's talking about, but he's, again, wise enough not only to talk about it in personal terms, how it's affecting me emotionally, but to not, you know, specifically say, "You remember Jerusalem, the one that you said nobody could rebuild? That's the one I want to go rebuild." He lets the king come to that conclusion on his own. And then we get another prayer of Nehemiah in verse 4. It's called by some writers the Arrow Prayer. For what that's worth, if you ever hear about Nehemiah's arrow prayer, this is what is being talked about. It's in verse 4. "The king said to me, 'What are you requesting?' So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, 'If it pleases the king,'" and if, wait a second, what was the prayer? you don't know. You get no picture of it, but you know he prayed something, and you know he didn't have a lot of time to pray it, because, you know, he can't just stand there and, you know, twiddle his thumbs for 5 minutes while he waited to respond to the king. He had to respond quickly, and so he prayed quickly. And this is, of course, an outstanding example of an informal prayer, a silent prayer, a personal prayer, a prayer that really had to happen so fast that it really had no time for words, so to speak. But it's not a superficial prayer. It's easy to look at something like this, and if what he said in his mind was, "God, help me in this situation," that's a prayer. And it's easy to look at that and say, that's a really superficial prayer, but obviously it's not, because God hears him and answers him. And also obviously it's not, because it's based on 4 months of serious prayer, of prayer and fasting and everything that had been leading up to this point. Now, if all you ever do when you're praying is walking around going, "God, help me," when you're in a little bit of a bind, that's superficial praying. But if you pray fervently at other times and then pray quick prayers when you need God's assistance in quick situations, that's a completely different thing. And that shows faith in God in every situation instead of pseudo-faith in God when you're in a bind. And I think there's a big difference in those two things.
Well, I've never put these together. I mean, whenever I've gone through studies on this, this is really the first time that I've really realized that he spent 4 months preparing for this. Because you'll hear people talk about, Nehemiah's prayer and how this is an example of, you need something, you pray really quick, and that type of thing. And I've even had people make jokes about a Nehemiah prayer and just it being so so quick and such. But really, like you said, it could have been, "God, this is what I've been praying about for 4 months." And,
yeah.
Who knows? But really, it puts a whole different spin on this prayer that I've never really thought about. Didn't realize that it had even happened. So.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about his sad countenance is so much time has passed. I mean, you read the two chapters back to back without picking up the month reference. Or knowing the Hebrew calendar, which I don't guess most of us do off the top of our heads. I certainly don't. It's easy to say, "Oh, he heard this bad news, he prayed, and he went to work, and obviously he was sad because, he just heard about it." Well, something has happened in between that really, puts a question mark on that kind of interpretation. All right, well then we find Nehemiah's response in verses 5 through 8, where he asks to be allowed to return to Judah for a time to rebuild the city. And again, he doesn't mention Jerusalem. He leaves that to the king to figure out. He asks for royal documents to support him in what he wants to accomplish. And it's obvious also that when you get to this point and you see what he's asking for and the way he asks it, verse 7, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of the province beyond the river. They may let me pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me." I mean, how different would it have been if Nehemiah had heard the news, gone home and prayed, and went back the next day, And the king says, "What are you so sad about?" "Well, the city of my fathers is in ruins, and I'd really like to go rebuild it." And the king says, "Okay, what are you going to need?" And he says, "I'm not sure. I hadn't really thought that far ahead." I mean, that would be a whole lot less impactful on the king than at this point, where obviously he's not just been praying, he's been planning as well. So when the moment comes to ask, he's not just on a whim, he's not just on an impulse. The king is, it's obvious to the king that he's very serious about this, not just because how it impacted him emotionally, but by how obviously he's been thinking about this and what he's going to do when he has the opportunity to do it. It's all very well thought out, and so that's the kind of thing that would impress the king as well.
That's a very good point for us to make application with. In our daily lives, whenever we realize there may be situation that's going to need a great deal of strength or courage or planning or something, when we're overwhelmed, we need to both pray about it and make thoughts ahead of time prepared.
Yeah.
So that we're not just acting on a whim and just kind of haphazardly
And then this section ends with a little note that's really easy to read past. Does anyone remember what one of the phrases that ran through, I think it was Ezra 7 to 10, every time they were successful, it pointed out that the hand of God was upon them, and that was just the running theme through all of that. All of their success was based on that. Well, that shows up again here at the very end of verse 8. The king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. Nehemiah understands the source of his success was not his planning, but the graciousness of God. Well, then the end of chapter 2 tells us about Nehemiah and his adversaries who show up along the way. It begins in verse 9 by talking about the entourage that Nehemiah comes with. The king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen, which is an important point, not only because he gets protection from them, the kind of protection that Ezra had refused in his day, Nehemiah takes with him, but also it's kind of arriving in style, we might say. He knows he's going to face opposition when he gets there, and the fact that he has officers of the king with him kind of gives credentials to his paperwork that he has, the letters going with him. These neighboring governors aren't going to be happy about him, and the change of this royal policy, but when you have the king's army with you, or part of it at least, it kind of reinforces that these letters aren't forged. The king really wants this done, which then may also tell us why Nehemiah's enemies are constantly bluffing about what they're going to do instead of actually doing it, because Nehemiah has the king's support, not only in paperwork, but with some soldiers to go along with it. Well, we then hear about Nehemiah's enemies, two of them specifically who show up over and over and over again. Sanballat is what I'll call him, the Horonite, and Tobiah, the Ammonite servant, heard it, and this displeased them greatly. These guys are fairly important, but what I want to point out at this point is the geography of where these guys are coming from in relation to Nehemiah and the work that he's doing. Sanballat, interestingly, is one of those guys who shows up in a lot of extra-biblical literature, things other than what the Bible talks about. And what we learn from all of the other writing is that Sanballat was a governor in Samaria, and which, of course, we know Samaria was the northern part of Palestine. It's where the Samaritans are in the time of Jesus. Tobiah the Ammonite, it's possible that he's not an Ammonite nationally so much as he is an Ammonite legally. Tobiah is a name that is carried by a powerful family in Ammon for centuries to come after this point. There are a bunch of Tobiahs in Ammon, and they were all very powerful. So when it says that he is the servant, probably what it means is that he's the king's servant, and it's just kind of a contemptuous way of saying that, calling him a servant instead of his actual position. But what I want to point out at this point is, if you remember your geography, my apologies for my art, but Nehemiah's working down here in Judah. Sanballat's up here in Samaria. And Tobiah's over here in Ammon. So he's beginning to get surrounded by his enemies already. And that becomes even more clear when you get down to the end of the chapter. And we'll go ahead and talk about this now. There's another guy who shows up in verse 19. There's Sanballat again. There's Tobiah again. And there's Geshem, the Arab, who shows up at this same point as well. And Geshem is another guy who's written about in literature outside the Bible. And what we find out about him is that he and his son ruled a league of Arabian tribes, which took control of Moab and Edom and parts of Arabia and all the way down into the entries of Egypt, we might say. And so again, now we've got Moab here, and Edom, and Arabia, I probably can't even see that anymore, and down into the beginning of Egypt. That's a little too low. But you get the idea. Here's Nehemiah, and here are his enemies. There is nowhere that he can go at this point to have any kind of allies in any geographical direction. He is completely surrounded by his enemies. Well, wrapping this up very quickly, he gets to town and he takes a night ride. Sorry, I'll not make a television show joke. Well, as we might expect from 4 months of of his praying. When he gets there, he doesn't rush into any kind of action upon arriving. He wants to take this slowly and take it the right way, plan it out, and work that way. So he doesn't tell anybody what's going on at this point. At night, when no one's watching, he goes and he makes a circuit of the city to see what needs to be done to the walls. He thoroughly acquaints himself with the situation before telling them what his plan is. It's just good leadership is what it is. You don't show up on a new scene and say, all right, I'm in charge now and here's what we're going to do. You make sure you know what's going on first, and that's exactly what Nehemiah does. And then the section ends with Nehemiah and the people. He announces his plans to them in verses 17 and 18. And again, we find in verse 18, I told them that the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also the words of the king that the king had spoken to me. The hand of God was on them again. That theme is continuing even further, which guarantees at the outset that they're going to be successful, is that the hand of God is on them. But notice also that he mentions the hand of God before he mentions the word of the king. In his mind, that's what's more important. And it shows the cause and effect relationship. Why did the king tell him these things? Why did the king give him this paperwork? Why did the king send his soldiers with him? Well, it's because the hand of God was on him. And the people agree, they want to work. And then we find that opposition again in verse 19, where Geshem the Arab shows up. He's not happy either. Nehemiah is completely surrounded by his enemies. And notice also what it says there in verse 19. What is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Well, obviously he's not. He's got the paperwork to prove it, and he's got the soldiers to prove it. But that's one of those buzzwords, you know, rebelling against the king. That, you know, that's going to raise flags whether it's true or not, and people are going to have to take a big step back and think about that, especially, again, when the last thing the king said about this was stop doing it. And if you remember when that letter was first sent back in Ezra chapter 4, what they said was, this is a rebellious people. And if you look back at the history of Jerusalem, you go check the archive documents, what you're going to find is this is a wicked and rebellious people. They're always rebelling against the emperor. And so, again, that's what they're trying to bring up at this point, to stop the work, to, you know, get everyone to worry about it. And, oh, no, we can't help Nehemiah. He's rebelling against the king. But, of course, that's not successful. And Nehemiah's reply in verse 20, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. Initially, he had referred to the king's decree, which, of course, counters the accusation of rebellion. Clearly, he's not rebelling because he said at the outset that the king was supporting this. But at this point, he no longer refers to the king, but only refers to God. So again, you see where his emphasis is, that it's not the king who's supporting this being as important as the fact that God is supporting this. And that's where the real power, that's where the real authority is, God over mankind, over policy, over emperors. And that's a point that runs through all of these books, time and time again, that God is the one who is in control. He is the one who's running the situation. Cyrus decides he's going to do his policy because God is in control. Xerxes does what he does because God is in control. Artaxerxes does what he does because God is in control. The people go back to build because God is in control. And it's one time after another. That is the real source of everything, and it's true here as well. And ultimately, that's the downfall of Sanballat and these guys, is they don't take into the fact that God is in control. They think they're going to stop things by their own initiative. And so, ultimately, of course, they will fail. And then Nehemiah ends by saying, you don't even have any right to be here, much less tell us what we can do here. You have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. Why are you here telling us what it is we can and can't do? So that's how that chapter ends. And then Wednesday week, we'll be looking at chapters 4 and 5. Any last comments?